The Federal Reserve held interest rates steady today, and the yield on the 30-year Treasury bond rose to its highest level since 2007. Those two facts, in that order, are the whole story of this week. Conventional reading says a central bank that declines to raise rates has delivered easier money than expected, and long-term borrowing costs should ease with it. That is not what happened. The 2-year Treasury yield fell about 4 basis points to 4.24%. The 10-year rose 5 basis points to 4.66, and the 30-year went to a 19-year high. The Dow closed 1,100 points lower, its worst single day in more than a year. Short-term rates down, long-term rates up. Same news, same afternoon, opposite directions. That is not a market repricing Federal Reserve policy. That is a market repricing Federal Reserve credibility. And the gap between those two moves, the short end falling while the long end rises, is that credibility loss measured in basis points on the day it happened. I'm Jason Keyes. Every other week, I score a prediction this framework put on the record. I work through what's actually happening, and I give you dated specifics you can hold me to. 3 things scored today, one of them wrong. Let's start there. First, the one I got wrong. In Article 36, published earlier this month, I made an argument I called the June 17th Institutional Pivot. 2 things happened that day. Kevin Warsh chaired his first meeting as Fed chair and produced a statement roughly a third the length of the Powell-era norm, a deliberate retreat from 3 decades of forward guidance. And at the G7 at Versailles, that same day, Trump and Iranian President Pezeshkian signed a 14-point memorandum opening a 60-day window to resolve the Strait of Hormuz crisis. I read those as connected. 2 arms of one government, same day, both conceding their prior approach had hit a ceiling. 21 days later, on July 8th, Trump said at the NATO summit in Ankara that the deal was over. A waste of time, in his words. That same day, Treasury rescinded the waiver that had let Iran sell crude on the world market. So the executive half of that thesis was wrong. Not early. Wrong. And the error has a name. I treated 2 events sharing a date as evidence of a shared underlying cause, pattern matching on coincidence. I should have caught it, because the 2 objects were never comparable. A Federal Reserve statement requires committee consensus, published minutes, 12 votes. A leader's signature requires nothing beyond that leader's continued interest. It held for 3 weeks. But the Federal Reserve half of that thesis is not just holding. It got stronger today. Today's vote was 9-3. 3 regional presidents, Hammock of Cleveland, Kashkari of Minneapolis, Logan of Dallas, dissented, all 3 wanting a quarter-point hike. That's the first time since September 2016 that 3 policymakers dissented with a unified view of which direction rates should go. Most coverage is reading that as a problem for Warsh. A new chair losing 3 votes. Credibility under strain. And when he was asked about it directly, here is what he said. Quote, I asked for a good family fight, and I got... That's the designed feature. Designed feature. That's a chair telling you the dissent is the point, which is exactly what Article 32 argued the pivot was. A deliberate move away from manufactured consensus and forward guidance, toward a committee that visibly disagrees in public. If you thought that pivot was accidental, or a communication stumble by someone new to the job, today should settle it. He welcomed it on the record. So the corrected scorecard, wrong on the executive branch, right on the Federal Reserve, and I should have kept those 2 claims in separate sentences from the start. Second, today's own call, which I need to score carefully. I scripted the first version of this episode this morning before the decision deliberately and stated my expectation on the record, a hold with hawkish language, correct on both. Rates held at 3.5% to 3.75%, the 5th consecutive pause, the longest since the 2008 cycle. And the language was hawkish, Warsh said. The committee has, quote, no tolerance for persistently elevated inflation, and described a resolute commitment to restoring price stability. But I want to be precise about what I missed, because I was right is a weaker claim than it sounds. I said hawkish language. What arrived was a hawkish revolt, 3 votes, unified, same direction, first time in nearly a decade. I forecast the tone and missed the magnitude. Those are different calls, and only the smaller one was mine. Article 36 predicted the Development Finance Corporation's $40 billion maritime facility would fail to write meaningful business. 5 months operational. Policies written, zero. Still zero. That call holds, and it held earlier and harder than I forecast because the diplomatic framework it depended on collapsed in early July rather than mid-August. Now, the part that matters most, and where I think this framework says something the general coverage isn't saying, the credibility repricing. Go back to those three yields. 2-year down, 4 basis points. 10-year up, 5. 30-year at a 19-year high. Decompose what the market is actually saying. The short end falling means investors believe the hold. They've lowered the odds of a hike in September. That's a policy read, and it's ordinary. But the long end rising, at the same time, on the same news, is saying something else entirely. Long-term yields price. Long-run inflation expectations. If bond investors believe this committee will return inflation to 2% over the coming decade, 30-year yields would not be at levels last seen before the financial crisis. So the message is, we believe you're not hiking, and we don't believe you'll hit your target. That's not a disagreement about the next meeting. That's a discount applied to an institution's word. J.P. Morgan's chief U.S. economist said it more diplomatically, that Warsh's remarks raise questions about the new chair's credibility in delivering lower inflation. The bond market said it in basis points. Now, why? This matters specifically for this framework. This is the connection I'd want you to take away from the episode. 2 weeks ago, I published a long piece arguing that falling interest rates destroy capital invisibly through an accounting asymmetry dating to 1914 that has never been corrected. Short version. When rates fall, the real cost of extinguishing your existing fixed-rate debt rises, and no accounting standard requires anyone to record that as a loss. It compounded silently from 1981 to 2020 across the entire 40-year decline in the rate structure. That piece also argued that the reversal since 2022, rates rising again for the first sustained stretch in 4 decades, should begin to repair that damage by running the same mechanism backward. Here's what today changes about that argument. I had framed the reversal as substantially policy-driven. Warsh being hawkish, the committee resisting cuts, but the 30-year yield did not reach a 19-year high because the Fed acted. It got there because the Fed held and the market repriced anyway. That makes the reversal more durable, not less. A rate structure rising because a central bank chose to raise rates can reverse the moment that central bank changes its mind or its chair. A rate structure rising because bond investors have independently lost confidence in the inflation target is not something a committee can vote away. If the capital repair mechanism I described is real, today made it more likely to persist, and for a reason I had not accounted for when I wrote it 3 weeks ago. 2 shorter observations. Gold. It held above $4,050 today, trading near $4,066, absorbing a hawkish surprise without breaking. Still down roughly 27% from January's all-time high of $5,589. 2 weeks ago, I published the argument that gold's price is driven not by this framework's diagnosis of unsound money, but by the real interest rate, nominal yields minus inflation expectations. That work isn't mine and isn't contested. Erb and Harvey measured the correlation at negative 0.82. So watch what just happened. Nominal long yields rose sharply. Gold didn't break. That's only coherent if inflation expectations rose roughly as much as nominal yields did, meaning real rates barely moved. Which is the same credibility story, read off a different instrument. And I'll say the uncomfortable part plainly since I hold the position. 27% down, diagnosis unchanged. And I'm not selling, not out of conviction, out of arithmetic. The position was sized so a drawdown like this is survivable. That was the whole purpose of sizing it that way. And this is the week it gets tested rather than theorized. And one smaller thing I found genuinely striking. June's inflation print came in at negative 0.4% for the month, the largest single-month decline since April 2020. Asked about it today, Warsh said it was, quote, not much of a consideration for him, and affirmed that inflation remains elevated. This framework has argued for years that the consumer price index is a rear-facing instrument routinely used as a forward-facing one. Today, a sitting Federal Reserve chair declined to wait a favorable headline print because he could apparently see through it. He would not describe that as agreeing with me, and I'm not claiming he would, but the behavior is the framework's behavior, and it's worth noting when it shows up from that direction. Five things, dated so you can score me. 1. August 12th, July's Consumer Price Index. Brent crude settled above $100 a barrel last Thursday, first time in 2 months, up about 10% for that week after the Iran framework collapsed. June's soft print described a world that no longer exists. If July comes in soft anyway, my read on energy pass-through is wrong, and you'll hear it here first. 2. The September meeting. The number I'm watching isn't the rate, it's the descent count. 3 today. J.P. Morgan's view is that more may join if the data doesn't improve quickly. If September brings 4 or more, this stops being a chair running a lively committee and becomes a chair losing one. 3. The 30-year yield. That's the direct test of whether today was a one-day reaction or a regime change. My published thesis says the rate structure reversal is real and durable. A 30-year that retreats back below 4.5% within a quarter is evidence against me. 4. Mid-August. The 60-day memorandum formally expires, already repudiated. Watch whether anything replaces it, or whether this hardens into the forefront problem now running at once. Hormuz, the Red Sea, the Caspian Pipeline, and Iranian export terminals. 5. This one's mine to deliver. Public companies disclose the fair value of their long-term debt in the footnotes, separately from the carrying value on the balance sheet. For fixed-rate debt, the gap between those two numbers is precisely the unrecorded capital destruction I wrote about, the loss that falling rates create and that no standard requires anyone to book. It sits in machine-readable filings, quarterly, for thousands of companies, and essentially nobody aggregates it. I'm building that series. When it runs, this show is where I walk through what it shows, including if it embarrasses the thesis. One closing thought. I opened with a call I got wrong, and that ordering is deliberate and permanent. This framework's value doesn't rest on being right often. Anyone can be right often by staying vague. It rests on making claims specific enough to be scored and then actually scoring them, including on the days that's unpleasant. Today, the executive half of the June 17th thesis was wrong. The Federal Reserve half got stronger, and the chair said so himself. I called the hold in the hawkish tone and underforecast the revolt. The reinsurance facility is still at zero. Gold is down 27%, and my position is unchanged for reasons I published before it fell, rather than after. That's the method. Say the thing, date it, come back to it. Next episode in 2 weeks, after the July inflation print, I'm Jason Keyes. This has been The Framework's Reading.